Hi, my name is Emmy from the Vegan for Life podcast, which you can find at vegan-for-life.blogspot.com, and you're listening to Coexisting with Non-Human Animals.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Vegetarian.
Vegan.
Yeah,
let's get it right.
You used the word animals, but I suppose what you should have said is non-human animals. If you want to make the problem.
Combining vaguely Dolly Parton sounding house beats with that marvelous sense of humor we Schwarzenegger-esque Austrians are known for. It's coexisting with non-human animals. Gohan to you all. Recording about 8 hours prior to the Apple announcement of the glorious iPhone 5. Welcome to episode 65 of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals. Obey Hin Mother. I've got a lot of exciting news to share. Invercargill had another vegan / vegetarian cooking class. I wasn't thrilled about the vegetarian aspect. To see a couple birds' eggs being broken into a bowl isn't that attractive, especially when you've seen where eggs come from. And by that, I don't just mean the evil factory farming cruel cages version. No, I mean even when you have some female hen friends who live happily in the backyard, and they painfully shoot out an egg from their bottom, where you can sometimes still a faint trace of mucus or poop smeared on it. And people want to put that in their mouths? No thank you. I'd managed to rustle up a contingent from the Invercargill Vegan Society to attend. Russell being the correct term, there were to be both InverSoc members with Russell in their names, a man with the first name of Russell, and Catherine Russell. Sadly, Catherine was held up with a vet appointment. It was great not being the only vegan in the class, having to get the little jokes like, "Any other vegans here? Apart from Jordan, anybody, nobody, it's just Jordan, like always, all alone, the only vegan in the cooking class, yeah, I thought so." Well, not this time, there were 7 vegans, 7, I saw Alicia and Sophie had put an InverSoc bumper sticker on their car, and together, we all walked to the nearby Otapuni Gardens afterwards to take a group photo. I asked Kerry to write on a sign, "We are vegan." And we've sent the image in to the Faces of Vegan project, showing what the planet's vegan population looks like. You can find Faces of Vegan at www.lisaviger.com/faces. After Yellow Hen was also attacked by a cat, she's returned home from the vet clinic, nearly as good as new. It was a little odd ringing a taxi to take a hen to the vet a few times. Hello, I'd like a taxi please, I'm at 123 Fake Street. Thank you. Oh, and I'll be taking 2 hens and a banana box to the vet. Is that okay? Thanks. I kept Black Chick, the only other survivor with Yellow Hen at the vet's. I didn't want them to be separated, to be lonely by themselves. Eventually, Black Chick was reported to have pecked her sister. That's not on, and so they were put in separate cages. Something else that's not a nice feeling. To take these hens who are born free, to live in our backyard their natural lives, to put them in a box and take them in a taxi to a vet clinic that sells dead chickens in huge bags as pet food, for them to be kept in cages by non-vegans, it is upsetting. On a later visit, On advice from my good friend Susan Elias, I baked a vegan cake for the vets as a small token of thanksiation. My whiny vegan sensibilities had been offended by leaflets on the clinic's counter. How to train puppies for blood sports. How to be gun dogs. I wasn't sure how to broach the topic with these people who'd saved my little friend's life without deeply offending them or getting upset myself. I took one of the leaflets home. Most puppies that are destined to be duck-shooting dogs are gun dogs, and as such are natural retrievers. You have to get them used to it as early as possible. Choose special toy that you reserve specifically for your retrieving training. This toy is not for playing tug with and should not be left lying around. You should get it out only for your retrieve training sessions. Choose a plastic dumbbell so it floats. To get your dog used to the scent of game, and scent of game is made bold, attach a duck wing to the dummy by covering it with an old sock. And remember to introduce your dog to gunfire, in bold, before the big event. It is very important to introduce your dog carefully, as many gun dogs have been made gun-shy through carelessness with introductions. Because that'd be really embarrassing, right? If you went to go out with a dog and went to go shooting small birds for fun. And imagine if your dog was afraid of big bangs and lethal firearms. Funny. I knew the vet clinic I visited was part of a rural chain, and would hence be very, shall we say, non-vegan. On advice from my friend Susan, I rang an after-hours number for the closest vet clinic I could find online, very late at night. I explained, very nervously, that a chicken had been attacked badly, that I thought a cat was responsible, and that she had very bad wounds on each side of her neck. When I first described the situation, the vet repeated back, "A chicken," in a way that made me extra nervous, as if she was going to say, "Are you friggin' kidding me? It's late at night, you're ringing me about a chicken? Listen, buddy, we kill a couple hundred bloody chickens each second, okay? I visited killing friendly chickens this afternoon. Don't waste my friggin' time with a hurt hen." To her credit, the vet went so far as to visit my house, to take Yellow Hen and Black Chick back to the vet clinic, as I had no car of my own. I was nervous about the damage, as I understood it. Yellow Hen had been attacked sometime at night before I closed the door to the chickens' sheds. They live in two proper buildings, really. One is a landline telephone, a light, large windows, shelves, etc. Both are made from brick. They're far from dinky little tin shed somewhere. I close the main door at night and open it for them in the morning. I was told about the after-hours fee of over $100. I described how I thought Yellow Hen must have been attacked, left for dead, that she must have staggered up the ramp to a nesting box to die in the safest place she could reach. I told the after-hours vet how others had been badly attacked, presumably by cats, and had died in my arms before, that I thought Yellow Hen was so very close to death. I was somewhat talked out of having the vet stop by, the over $100 fee, that she would probably need antibiotics from a cat attack, how cats have filthy mouths, and how she could be brought in the next morning. I thanked the vet very much for her time and hung up. About 10 minutes later, after checking Yellow Hen several times, she wanted to be left alone in the still dark. Chickens can't see in the dark, and she'd been badly injured, I think fatally injured without intervention. She'd stumbled about and up the ramp to a familiar location, a nesting box, and she was preparing to die there. She didn't want to be touched or moved, to have my torchlight near her. I'd left her there, and went inside our house before deep feelings of guilt hit me. I'd spent over $100 on sending InvoSoc badges around the world to friends, as a sign that vegans were everywhere around the world, so that each honorary member could take a photo of themselves with their badges, and that these photos could be shared on the Invercargill Vegan Society website. We are InvoSoc, the page will be called eventually, to show our global friendship, solidarity, and veganism. I'd given more than the after-hours fee to individual animal sanctuaries, and I was about to leave my hen friend to presumably die in the dark, surrounded by straw, the darkness, unable to see, in pain, blood all over her neck, huge wounds through her neck, perhaps through her earway. My little friend, who, despite being too shy to be patted, always followed me around the garden, who likes being around me, and who trusts me, and I would let her die in some shed, because of being so nervous and upset and panicked. And the only downside, apart from being upset, was $100 lousy. The vet drove around to my house late at night, said that the wounds were actually much worse than expected. Remember, I'd been somewhat reassured about bringing her into the clinic the next morning. Yellow Hen was treated with painkillers and had the wound cleaned. She was left overnight and further treated in the morning. I thought Yellow Hen was going to die in my arms. I couldn't do anything to help her myself, and she didn't like being touched. She wanted to be left alone. As I tried to get her to eat grain from my hand, to have water, chickweed, anything, to keep up her strength after losing so much blood, she wouldn't budge. She would, in fact, turn her back to me to try and get away from my hand. She must have been in a lot of pain, to have wanted to be left alone, to die in the darkness. And my friend Susan kept a clear head. I emailed her about what had happened, upset, and she replied to me late at night. I rang a local vet. They had an after-hours number. It seemed so easy to give up hope for Yellow Hen, that so many other chickens had been killed by cats. I'd come home after work, calling out to my chicken friends, and had found one of them lying sprawled out, dead in the backyard, or they'd been very ill and had died in my arms. And my friend Susan gave me such important advice about the germs cats carry, how an infection would be building in her wounds, and that she needed urgent help from a vet. It reminds me of the never-ending story of feeling so helpless that you're okay, that the neighborhood cats won't attack me because I'm so much larger than them, I can protect myself, that they attack those smaller and weaker than themselves who cannot run away and who cannot defend themselves. They have a long, weak neck and a small beak, and when the cats pounce on them in the dark and crush their neck, sinking two sets of teeth in, two sets of claws into their feathered bodies, they can't help themselves, can they? I'm not sure why the cat hadn't finished off Yellow Hen. Perhaps I can imagine Black Chick in some way saved her sister, the way Yellow Hen stood up to Mr. Rooster when he kept charging at my foot. The 1984, film, Never Ending Story, is one of those old, scary-as-hell movies supposedly made for children. Like Return to Oz, and actually E.T., the movie with that freaky-looking screaming alien who kept hiding in someone's house and yelling and screaming after being found by the young kids, and they screamed too. It creeped me out while I was younger. It's all about people losing faith, people losing their beliefs, and hence the fictional world and the never-ending story ends. Perhaps I could overstretch and say, it's an analogy of how children grow from being amazed by other animals to seeing them as commodities, as things to be used as we grow into supposed maturity. The never-ending story, which is actually 94 minutes long in the English version, features a large stone giant who gave up hope after his, quote, little friends were killed.
They look like big, good, strong hands, don't they? I always thought that's what they were. My little friends, the little man with his racing snail, the night hawk, even the stupid bat. I couldn't hold on to them. The nothing pulled them right out of my hands. I failed.
No, you didn't fail. I'm the one who failed. I was the one chosen to stop the nothing. But I lost the Auron. I can't find my luck dragon. So I won't be able to get beyond the boundaries of Fantasia.
Listen. The nothing will be here any minute. I will just sit here and let it take me away, too. They look like good, strong hands, don't they?
And that's a child's movie. A movie that's meant to inspire children. When things get bad and you feel like you can't do anything, to just give up and wait for, I don't know, the nothing to kill you too. Isn't that inspiring, kids? With friends like Susan, I didn't give up, and neither did Yellow Hen. With care at the vet clinic, requiring 2 visits, a stay of about a week, and a bill of about $200, she's doing fine now. And thanks to some of my other friends, George and Sharon, I've now also got 2 rescued hens from a battery cage farm, living here, with Black Chick and Yellow Hen. I hope that they can live happy, free lives here. At the moment, I let the 4 hens out from their shed each morning, placing them 1 by 1 in our safe glass house for the day. They're safe from cats inside. I'm not sure if cats would try to hurt the twice as large rescued hens, but for safety, I keep them all there while I'm away. I hope that I can take in more rescued hens soon, with a nice little flock again of large hens who've been taken away from existing in the dark, in cages, and being neglected and treated horribly and to maybe have given up hope, to have them living free in the garden of a vegan with other hens so that they can have never-ending happiness. That I can fly around with my sort of luck dragon chicken friends and...
Yeah. Yeah,
let's see how these chickens like being free, I think he means, as we chase the nasty childhood police down an alleyway on the back of our luck dragon Falcor. Don't worry, he wants to take us for a magical flying voyage. And, oh yeah, one of the bullies looks just like that nasty Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook. And they jump into a rubbish bin. Oh no, we're dirty. The dragon likes laughing at little boys being made dirty. And possibly soiling themselves too.
Bastion made many other wishes and had many other amazing adventures before he finally returned to the ordinary world. But that's another story.
Sing along.
Turn around, look at what you see.
Showing its age a bit there as it fades out. And what a rip-off too. Just like that song that never ends that was to go on and on, my friends.
This is the song that doesn't end. Yes, it goes on and on, my friend. Some people started singing it, not knowing what it was. And they'll continue singing it forever just because this is the song that doesn't end.
The never-ending story theme also ended. I can't confirm or deny this, but I also reckon Wonka's everlasting gobstoppers were also a scam. Oh, children's pop culture, why do you insist on letting us down? The new hens are very nice, although their bodies tell a tale of ill treatment. They have scars, bumps, bruises, and missing feathers all around. One of the 2 hens has essentially no feathers at all around her neck, having been plucked bare. Presumably due to stress, these haven't grown back while living with other hens outside of the farm. They were outcasts among the small group of rescued chickens. My friend Sharon said she hoped they would be calmer while living here. Looking at them, their bodies are huge and angular, sort of lumpy. Their feathers are very thin, sparse, and small. They feel like steel wool over their papier-mâché bodies. The website of the vet clinic I took Yellow Hen to for treatment, Black Chick to accompany her sister, mentions production animals. that the vet specialised in making dairy cows, quote, perform. And the profiles for individual vet nurses themselves, many of them actually enjoy killing other animals with guns. Example, X will be working as a large animal vet, mostly with interests in all farming enterprises, especially dairy and deer. She will also be working some of her time in the small animal department. Outside of work, X enjoys hunting, shooting small game, running, biking, netball, and hockey. While shooting small animals to near death as a game and then patching them up for money, it sounds like a good business model, I guess. The idea that so many people whose job it is to care and heal other animals also enjoy directly killing them, it's weird. Looking at my new hen friends to see what we've done to chickens through selective breeding, that we see them as production animals. Oh, you are a production animal. We can do as we wish to you. You're here to make me money. It puts the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again. These clips come from a recent Intelligence Squared US NPR debate about the current American war against human rights, which I've linked to in this episode's show notes. Time to end the war on terror.
Successive American presidents have defined us as being at war with Al-Qaeda. The American Congress has defined us as being at war with Al-Qaeda. And the American court system, only a few blocks from here, has defined us as being at war with Al-Qaeda when a defendant attempting to claim he had been denied his right to a speedy trial because he had been in detention for several years, his claim was rejected by the court, saying that we, as a nation at war, had a right to detain him as a combatant.
What's that you say? A police officer ran over your wife, then shot your daughter, and stole your son's tofu burger? Hey, we're at war, you know, buddy. Anything goes. Real patriots sit down and shut up about our atrocities.
Now, we could discuss troop levels in Iraq, the rate of withdrawal from Afghanistan, a whole bunch of other details about this war. But that's not the point I think Rich and I want to make. The point we want to make is the legal construct, the legal belief that we are a nation at war.
The legal construct? A few paragraphs? Who am I kidding? A few reams of paper defining an atrocity can make it legally okay?
Everyone here is happy that Osama bin Laden was killed on the morning of the 2nd of May in Pakistan. Let me give you... Okay, thank you.
I'm not. I wish he could have been brought to justice with a trial so that more information could be gathered from him. At worst, he wouldn't say anything of use preventing future violence. Okay, so the big bad enemy still out there would see the Americans treated their latest mortal enemy, another one of those guys they supplied with training, weapons, and millions in cash a couple decades back, that they were treated with basic human dignity. Wouldn't that at least help lead them to believe, gee, maybe these guys are not our mortal enemy, maybe we could be nicer to them too?
But let me give you a slightly different description of that event. A heavily armed agent of the United States government was in a room with an unarmed man who was under indictment in the United States judicial system and who was offering no significant resistance to the heavily armed agent of the United States government, and that heavily armed agent of the United States government killed him. If you do not think we are at war, there are some very troubling definitions that you might want to attach to that act. That's the kind of authority we have, perfectly lawful. And in no way am I suggesting anyone acted inappropriately. We acted perfectly lawfully because we are a nation at war and generally recognized as such.
So according to this legal construct thingy-majig, it was technically legal at the time, which makes it okay. And as long as we keep believing in the Emperor's lovely new robes, well, that makes them true, too. And on torture... Sorry... I was acting like a whiny vegan liberal there. And on enhanced interrogation methods.
Don't want to take those tools off the table while there are terrorists out there. If you let this tool go, you will be less safe. Okay.
If you believe in basic human rights, you make us all less safe, and you're a commie, and you're no better than Bin Laden himself, and you probably wish you could have gay-married the guy, you awful liberal you. And this is all because there's still terrorists apparently out there? Well, is there ever going to be a time when there's no terrorists or bad guys out there, and that we can have all our rights given back to us? Currently, the rescued hens have several very un-chicken-like habits, like sleeping curled up in the nesting boxes rather than sleeping standing upright, as high up as they can get, you know, like birds do. No doubt from living in cages, they've gotten used to crouching where they could, crammed wing to wing with other hens. I often check that they are all okay at night. It was quite shocking for me to see them the first time, two rescued hens sleeping side by side. They look like two brown cats together. Of course, I'll be happier if they relearn natural behaviour and sleep standing up beside black chick and yellow hen up there, if their feathers come back. But I'll like them no matter what they look like, or how oddly, for chickens, they sleep. I'm not going to try and correct their perceived errors.
Bill has a very sweet little daughter.
Oh, look at the little baby!
Oh, what the devil is that ghastly noise?
It's me, Eliza Pinchley. You are a flower, little baby.
Excuse me, what I think you mean to say is, would I like a flower? Heavens, you don't so much speak the language as chew on it and spit it out.
Gone, what's wrong with the way I talk?
Everything. Look, here's a shiny sixpence if you keep your mouth shut and go away. No, no, no. If you're ever going to be a lady, you must learn to speak like one. Now try it again. The life of the wife is ended by the knife.
The life of the wife?
No, not life. Life, life.
That's what I said, life.
Now listen to me, you tin-eared piece of baggage. We've got 5 days left, and I'll not lose my wager. Now repeat after me. Hello, mother. Have you hidden my hatchet?
Hello, mother. Have you hidden my hatchet?
Oh, God, no. It's an H sound, you moron. H. Ha, 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 ha.
Ew, your breath smells like kitty litter.
I was curious. Once again, here is how it should sound. How do you do? And here's how you sound. Now try it again.
How do you do?
What did you say?
The life of the wife is ended by the knife.
I think she's got it. I think she's got it.
The life of the wife is ended by the knife.
By George, she's got it! By George, she's got it! Now what ends her wretched life? And where's that bloody knife?
In the wife,
the life of the wife is ended by the knife.
Bravo, Eliza!
The life of the wife is ended by the knife.
Like all good Apple customers, I recently bought the audiobook version of a Steve Jobs biography I already own in hardcover. The Second Coming of Steve Jobs, from way back in the year 2000 or so. Hell, it was proclaiming him the greatest American ever to have lived before the iPod, iPhone or iPad. Imagine the praise now, greatest carbon-based life form yet discovered. Many mentions of snobby, elitist vegetarians and vegans.
Susceptible to his famous charisma. When they sat next to each other at dinner, she felt that he was trying to assert some kind of moral superiority by flaunting his vegetarianism. What do you recommend here? Asked Anne, since Steve had picked the restaurant. I assume that you eat meat, he said casually, but a bit condescendingly. I haven't eaten meat for 15 years, she shot back. Hollywood types thought that Steve's rhetoric and persona, the allusions to 60s counterculture and Zen, were just an act. They could easily see right through it. All that vegan feel-good shit cloaks that he's so cutthroat, says a Disney executive who worked closely with him.
Of course, Steve Jobs can't be vegan and couldn't be vegan. All throughout the book, there's mention of buying leather couches made out of, you know, dead animal skins. For one thing, Apple sells cases made from dead skin. If the Lord Jobs were vegan, he wouldn't put up with that kind of nonsense from his company that he rules with an iron fist, or at least is still chairman of the board of, or something like that these days.
Her new colleagues were surprised. They all had computers. Why a typewriter? I have all these forms to fill out, she said. Many actors worked on a shoot for only a day or two, and the producer needed to type out the forms to process their checks. Oh, don't worry, the Pixar people told her. We're all on salary here. We're PhDs. As Bonnie settled in, Disney sent an accountant to work full-time on the film. But what can we get you? Ralph asked. First, I need a typewriter, he said. The Pixar people were exasperated. They were running a high-tech operation. It was bad enough that they had to buy a typewriter for Bonnie. Use her typewriter. What else can we get you? I need a safe. A safe? Why? For the 10 grand in cash. The reason was very simple. Whenever there was a problem on a film set, the producer would open up the safe, pull out a pile of $100 bills, and hand out the bribes to the Teamsters. That was the quickest way to solve a problem. The Pixar guys had an Oscar, but only now were they getting an education in the real workings of Hollywood.
Gee, here in New Zealand, Witta hands out a shiny dollar coin or two. That usually ends any insurrections. Where? We don't want to actually be transformed into orcs, Pete. I've got a family to look after. It's going to be awfully hard selling real estate as an Uruk-hai. Wait, what's that? A dollar? $2? Where can I sign up? I've had some more half-baked ideas for future Invercargill Vegan Society recruitment materials. Some people of David Attenborough narrate their dreams. The rare Chinese leprechaun, Sino Guinness Goldman. Once my mysterious English guy who dreamed of being a voiceover actor was Dr. Roger Yates. I was fast asleep when the whole imbsoc idea sprang into my mind. I bolted upright in bed, tore off a sheet of paper, I don't know why I've still got one of those lying around, but apparently I do, and frantically scribbled in the dark, the V logo, imbsoc, Invercargill Vegan Society, well, it's actually sock, IIT, everything. I'd heard an echoing Dr. Yates going on about English sociologists and then English socialism, and Invercargill popped into mind. My lawyers inform me I don't have to give that guy a single penny of my future careerist hoardings, though. Dream appearances are uncredited, thank Jobs. These two ideas were fully mine, although, if you don't like them, they were totally dreamt up by that no-good Yates guy, okay? The first one would be some stickers using an image of Miss Hen. I often think of her as Mother Hen now. The stickers would be made and left on advertising posters around the city centre, nowhere permanent or hard to remove. They'd reference the Obey Giant art and 1984's Big Brother. At the top of the image of my draft design, there's the word, well, command would be more accurate, Obey. A photo of Miss Hen in the middle, and below, Hen Mother, Obey Hen Mother, is a parody of Big Brother. At the very bottom would be the Imbsoc website address, leaving the image cryptic, imposing, and hopefully a little fun. I've tried a couple versions, one with leaving the image of Miss Hen black and white, having used some filters to make the contrast stand out more, and another with a bright, dark blue. It was a bright, cold day in April when the clocks were striking 13. The blue vivid colour has an electric energy to it. It makes Miss Hen, aka Hen Mother, look more mysterious and commanding, as well as looking more upmarket than just black and white coloured stickers. Perhaps future revisions could have the tagline, "Listen to your mother," and maybe something like, "Eat your vegetables," although the vegan police would throw me in Guacamole Bay for that one. You have made the e-book reader mistake of focusing on the dietary component to veganism instead of the... Like I said, if you don't like the draft image you can find on my blog, www.coexistingwithnonhumananimals.co.nz. Blame Roger. If you like it, it was all my idea. The other idea would be a short video clip requiring animation. I'll have to wait until the American economy is even worse than its current sorry state, so that Industrial Light and Magic, or Pixar, are desperate for a 12-member vegan society at the bottom of the world submission. My idea would be to use a recent song, I'm a Machine, by dance music artist David Guetta. The video would focus on how we see other animals as mere things that, in particular, we kill 49 billion chickens each year, among the more than 56 billion other animals killed for our beliefs annually. Factory farming, battery cages, we see chickens as machines. Ow. The video would show different images of how chickens are exploited in farm conditions as property, in cages, picked up, put here and there, everywhere, kept barely alive for her eggs, and eventually driven to the slaughterhouse. I don't think I could easily and quickly explain what we do to baby roosters. I'd prefer not having graphic, i.e., yeah, I'll be leaving this part out of the ad. I'd prefer not having graphic, i.e. realistic resources for the Invercargill Vegan Society. Do not focus on shock and horror, blood and guts. Perhaps it could be shown Simpsons style, where the animals go in whole into the mysterious factory alive, all kinds of grinding noises, screams, stabbing sound effects, squirts of blood, and out the other end, a truck is loaded with plastic-wrapped packets. There'd be a breakdown during the video, with an unseen narrator, possibly Dr. Roger Yates if he can easily be bought off with a gold New Zealand dollar or two and shows aptitude for reading from a sappy script, before the video would end with, pretty obvious really, the animated chickens performing Michael Jackson's Thriller dance routine. Led by an illustration of Mr. Rooster, the hens would seemingly dance to the music, with their upright posture and wings easily able to perform the motions. Don't know why I stopped that bit again. The ad would fade out to text for the Invercargill Vegan Society, with a link to our website. Is this... so, okay, I'll leave this in. The music abruptly ends there, apparently. With a link to our website, as the song lyric, Show You Where To Go, also fades out. Images of hens being kept in awful conditions and treated as things, property, cages. There are machines, factory farms, battery hens. Then they get to the slaughterhouse. I want your body, baby. I want your body, baby. I wanna tear you apart and rebuild you, baby. I want your body, baby. I want your body, baby. I wanna tear you apart and rebuild you, baby. And this guy would morph into a kid. At, I don't know, KFC, making an order to bring it all home as they pass a little package over the counter and killing friendly chickens. And this part would have the breakdown, and it would have a voiceover saying something like, let's recognise chickens as someone, not something. We kill 49 billion of them a year. Let's put an end to that. Let's consider them our friends. Let's save them. Let's consider them undead. And this bit would have Mr. Rooster leading the Thriller dance routine with all the animated chickens dancing along. The msoc.org.nz URL comes up at the end. Yeah, as I said, if you don't like it, blame Roger. And if you do somehow like the idea of Thriller performing animated chickens promoting veganism, it was all my idea. Here's two local news stories. Those polluting farmers are at it again. Hundreds of thousands of dollars have been spent keeping Invercargill water from smelling and tasting putrid during the past 2 decades, but the problem appears to be getting worse, according to the City Water Services Manager. Invercargill City Council Water Services Manager, a bit redundant there, Alistair Murray, said the city had regular problems with a bad smell and taste in its drinking water during summer months since 1995. Ah, the good old days. Between $15,000 and $25,000 was spent each year addressing those problems, but it appeared to be getting worse, he said. South and water issues were highlighted this week in a report from Auditor General Lynn Provost, something like that. That sounds like a good Southland name, which criticised Environment Southland for its management of water quality risks. Bad odour and taste in Invercargill drinking water first became an issue in 1976 and was sporadic until the early 90s, but since 1995 the problem had occurred every year except one, Mr. Murray said. Increases in nitrate levels in Southland rivers was believed to be one of the causes, he said. The city's water was taken from a reedy river at Branxholme, but when the river was running low, it warmed up and caused the algal and soil bacteria to give off the compounds that caused the smell and odour, he said. However, since nitrates flowing down the river were increasing from intensified farm runoff, it may have prompted the algae to grow and cause the increased problem. Whether we can attribute that to changing farm practices, there is anecdotal evidence, but we don't have hard evidence. We would rather not have the problem, but we don't have control over our waterways, he said. Mr. Murray said the algal compounds in the drinking water did not pose a risk to health, but was unpleasant, and people did not like to put up with it. People's tolerance to the problem had diminished in latter years, compared with 3 decades ago, and that was a major reason for the cost, he said. Gee, we must be spoilt now, demanding our drinking water has to be clean and doesn't taste awful, as the Southern Times described it, has a bad smell and taste, and it was putrid. 2 clips from the Wellington-based radio show, Animal Rights and Wrongs. By the way, to lamb means the time when the mother sheep have had their pregnancies time to give birth. January is New Zealand's summer, our warm weather. We traditionally celebrate Happy December 25th Day, you know, all godless socialists are atheists, of course, on the beach. We have a tofu barbecue and a few cold beers while watching Home Alone and other fictional movies, you know, as if it could snow around Happy December 25th Day. And about snow being insulating. Yeah, that's why we all live in snow houses here in New Zealand.
Farmers Meat and Fibre Chairperson Jeanette Maxwell. Good morning, Jeanette.
Good morning, how are you?
Good.
We can't farm for 100% of the weather 100% of the time.
Has anybody been prosecuted, to your knowledge, for not providing adequate shelter for their animals?
Not to my knowledge.
Right, okay, so even like such as last year when such a large number of lambs died, was nobody accountable? Was that just, was that, as far as MAF were concerned, completely put down to weather conditions and that wasn't anybody's fault for not providing some sort of shelter for their animals?
We could provide all the shelter in the world, but you can't stop all lambs from dying, that's impossible.
Mm. And that was a lot of lambs though, wasn't it, last year?
Well, some years, you know, if you have a year, it was a September, if you have a very late snow, which is exactly what happened last year, it was spring. I mean, we can't, it's like trying to anticipate for snow on the 1st of January.
Mm.
You know, the later they lamb, the better the weather is.
Yeah.
Lambs died not so much because of the snow, because the snow in itself is very insulating, as I said earlier, it is the very cold wind is what kills them. And we can run around and put little jackets on. You can...
Some farmers do that, don't they?
Yeah, but you can, but the risk is that if it rains too much, it gets too heavy, it makes the lamb fall down, and then he can't keep up with his mum. So you've got to be very careful about when you decide to put the jacket on, because it can be detrimental. She can, you know, she might walk off to shelter or sit down, and the coat gets so heavy because, you know, 9 times out of 10 they're made out of wool, the poor little guy can't stand back up because the little coat you put on to protect him stopped him from hopping up to be able to have a feed. But...
Oh, that's a lovely image, the idea that, you know, if we go and do all these crazy animal welfare things that those damn liberal greenies are always asking us farmers to do, like putting little coats on them all out in the paddock there, you know, that wonderful natural fibre taken at force from gentle herbivores, and, you know, we do that by throwing them on their back on wooden shed floors, some guy in a singlet, taking to them with giant electric shears before throwing them down and out the shed for the next victim. That nature's greatest miracle, wool, well, maybe it isn't so great when it gets wet. And if we make these little coats for them out of their wonderful wool, and maybe it gets wet and they can't keep up with their mother and they basically starve because they can't get nourishment from their mother, thanks to those damn welfare laws and all the greenies and the wool. Well, gee, if only there was some synthetic replacement that we could all use instead of wool, for human beings too, of course, that held up under all weather conditions and was cheaper, lighter, didn't smell and was, you know, ethical. Something like a Gore-Tex or another man-made marvel of engineering. Oh, but that would be horrible and all synthetic and all, right? Another story. New Zealand Merino Company Chief Executive John Brackenridge said demand from customers meant they were running out of wool. This is another mechanism for being able to generate more wool by taking an animal through for an older age, Brackenridge said. There's more wool, there's more meat, because they're a bigger animal, and there is a better story associated with it, and therefore you can get more money. And by the way, I was going, yes, yes, sort of rubbing my hands together. As a rough guide, the joint venture Alpine Origin Merino was aiming to take the combined value of merino wool and meat from around $150 million a year to a potential $230 million a year during the next 5 years. There was about 3 million merino sheep in the national flock, and about 800,000 were sent to slaughter each year, of which the joint venture was aiming for 500,000 annually during probably the next 3 to 5 years. I take that to mean that the sheep are going to be kept alive longer, some more hair can be stolen from them, and that once we kill them, then they have a whole marvellous story made up, a PR image. Lovely merino flesh all the way from beautiful New Zealand, home of those movies about hairy midgets stealing New Zealand gold coins from a sleeping dragon. To quote the article again, there is a better story associated with it, and therefore you can get more money. Just like welfare reforms, really, with the American supermarket chain Whole Foods having all kinds of crazy animal welfare rating systems, with little stars showing how kind and humane and generous and good-looking and sexy the customer is, based on how much he's going to pay for shrink-wrapped corpse. There's bonus points for the animal being killed on the same farm they've grown up on, because we're eagerly informed, there's less stress when you kill them. And, you know, stress for the animal that we're about to kill, it's really bad, we shouldn't be mean to them. We shouldn't make them stressed before we, you know, kill them. And we do that for our pleasure and our profit. Yeah, because making someone stressed before you kill them, that would be terrible and mean and really, really nasty, right? The last episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals was about Iron Brian, the New Zealand beef and lamb, PR being shoveled into our primary schools.
Hey kids, if you want to be strong, you have to eat dead animals, but not just any old dead animals, killed and sent to you wrapped in plastic packets from any old country, but my sponsor's product, New Zealand cattle and sheep. Yay!
Yay, yay, we love you, Iron Brian! Well, maybe the Invercargill Vegan Society isn't being proactive enough in brainwashing the nation's youth. As always, we can plan our future from George Orwell's classic.
What was needed was a piece of pure fantasy. Suddenly there sprang into his mind, ready-made, as it were, the image of a certain Comrade Ogilvy, who had recently died in battle in heroic circumstances. There were occasions when Big Brother devoted his order for the day to commemorating some humble, rank-and-file party member whose life and death he held up as an example worthy to be followed. Today he should commemorate Comrade Ogilvy. It was true that there was no such person as Comrade Ogilvy, but a few lines of print and a couple of faked photographs would soon bring him into existence. Winston thought for a moment, then pulled the speak right toward him and began dictating in Big Brother's familiar style, a style at once military and pedantic, and because of a trick of asking questions and then promptly answering them, "What lessons do we learn from this fact, comrades? The lessons, which is also one of the fundamental principles of INGSOC, that..." etc., etc., easy to imitate. At the age of 3, Comrade Ogilvy had refused all toys except a drum, a submachine gun, and a model helicopter. At 6, a year early, by a special relaxation of the rules, he had joined the spies. At 9, he had been a troop leader. At 11, he had denounced his uncle to the Thought Police after overhearing a conversation which appeared to him to have criminal tendencies. At 17, he had been a district organizer of the Junior Anti-Sex League. At 19, he had designed a hand grenade which had been adopted by the Ministry of Peace and which, at its first trial, had killed 31 Eurasian prisoners in one burst. At 23, he had perished in action, pursued by enemy jet planes while flying over the Indian Ocean with important dispatches. He had weighted his body with his machine gun and leapt out of the helicopter into deep water, dispatches and all. An end, said Big Brother, which it was impossible to contemplate without feelings of envy. Big Brother added a few remarks on the purity and single-mindedness of Comrade Ogilvy's life. He was a total abstainer and a non-smoker, had no recreations except a daily hour in the gymnasium, and had taken a vow of celibacy, believing marriage and the care of a family to be incompatible with a 24-hour-a-day devotion to duty. He had no subjects of conversation except the principles of INGSOC, and no aim in life except the defeat of the Eurasian enemy and the hunting down of spies, saboteurs, thought criminals, and traitors generally.
Sounds like the ideal Invercargill Vegan Society member. Although, Change all that violence to non-violent vegan education, dreaming of nothing but ways to design Obey Hen Mother stickers from a young age and the like. We have to indoctrinate the children. Please, won't somebody brainwash the children?
Fingers as best he could in the cold water from the tap and went back into the other room. Up with your hands! Yelled a savage voice. A handsome, tough-looking boy of 9 had popped up from behind the table and was menacing him with a toy automatic pistol, while his small sister, about 2 years younger, made the same gesture with a fragment of wood. Both of them were dressed in the blue shorts, grey shirts, and red neckerchiefs which were the uniform of the spies. Winston raised his hands above his head, but with an uneasy feeling. So vicious was the boy's demeanour that it was not altogether a game. "You're a traitor!" yelled the boy. "You're a thought criminal! You're a Eurasian spy! I'll shoot you! I'll vaporize you! I'll send you to the salt mines!" Suddenly they were both leaping around him, shouting, "Traitor!" and "Thought criminal!" the little girl imitating her brother in every movement. It was somehow slightly frightening, like the gambolling of tiger cubs which will soon grow up into man-eaters. There was a sort of calculating ferocity in the boy's eye, a quite evident desire to hit or kick Winston, and a consciousness of being very nearly big enough to do so. It was a good job it was not a real pistol he was holding, Winston thought. Mrs. Parsons' eyes flitted nervously from Winston to the children and back again. In the better light of the living room, he noticed with interest that there actually was dust in the creases of her face. "They do get so noisy," she said. "They're disappointed because they couldn't go to see the hanging, that's what it is. I'm too busy to take them, and Tom won't be back from work in time." "Why can't we go and see the hanging?" roared the boy in his huge voice. "Want to see the hanging, want to see the hanging," chanted the little girl, still capering around. Some Eurasian prisoners guilty of war crimes were to be hanged in the park that evening, Winston remembered. This happened about once a month, and it was a popular spectacle. Children always clamored to be taken to see it. He took his leave of Mrs. Parsons and made for the door. But he had not gone 6 steps down the passage when something hit the back of his neck an agonizingly painful blow. It was as though a red-hot wire had been jabbed into him. He spun round just in time to see Mrs. Parsons dragging her son back into the doorway while the boy pocketed a catapult. "Goldstein!" bellowed the boy as the door closed on him. But what most struck Winston was the look of helpless fright on the woman's greyish face.
I love the clip of the little boy supposedly bellowing out, "Goldstein!" as if his arch-nemesis had somehow eluded him, or more accurately, his mother took him home. If I lived in America, I'd constantly be see something, say something, ing the government, phoning in reports of a Goldstein here, there and everywhere. We really have to win the children over. They are our future, you know.
All children nowadays were horrible. What was worst of all was that by means of such organizations as the spies, they were systematically turned into ungovernable little savages, and yet this produced in them no tendency whatever to rebel against the discipline of the party. On the contrary, they adored the party and everything connected with it. The songs, the processions, the banners, the hiking, the drilling with dummy rifles, the yelling of slogans, the worship of Big Brother. It was all a sort of glorious game to them. All their ferocity was turned outwards, against the enemies of the state, against foreigners, traitors, saboteurs, thought criminals. It was almost normal for people over 30 to be frightened of their own children, and with good reason. For hardly a week passed in which the Times did not carry a paragraph describing how some eavesdropping little sneak, child hero, was the phrase generally used, had overheard some compromising remark and denounced his parents to the thought police.
And who better a mascot for the children's to relate to than Hen Mother? Children'll go wild for a cute, lovable, broody, yet brooding, distant totalitarian matron who rules with an iron beak. And yeah, I am probably ripping off Mom from Futurama. I'm sure they too will learn to honour her image on posters.
Jim had folded up his strip of paper and stowed it away in his pocket. Parsons had begun talking again. "Did I ever tell you, old boy," he said, chuckling around the stem of his pipe, "about the time when those two nippers of mine set fire to the old market woman's skirt because they saw her wrapping up sausages in a poster of BB? Sneaked up behind her and set fire to it with a box of matches. Burned her quite badly, I believe, little beggars, eh? But keen as mustard. That's first-rate training they give 'em in the spies nowadays, better than in my day, even. What do you think's the latest thing they've served 'em out with? Ear trumpets, for listening through keyholes. My little girl brought one home the other night, tried it out on our sitting-room door, and reckoned she could hear twice as much as with her ear to the hole.
Of course, it's only a toy, mind you. Still gives them the right idea, huh?
An earlier clip mentioned the public hangings that the children are so fond of attending. There's plenty of violence shown in the world of 1984, especially in movies.
April 4th, 1984. Last night to the flicks. All war films. One very good one of a ship full of refugees being bombed somewhere in the Mediterranean. Audience much amused by shots of a great, huge, fat man trying to swim away with a helicopter after him. First you saw him wallowing along in the water like a porpoise, then you saw him through the helicopter's gun sights, then he was full of holes and the sea round him turned pink and he sank as suddenly as though the holes had let in the water, audience shouting with laughter when he sank. Then you saw a lifeboat full of children with a helicopter hovering over it. There was a middle-aged woman, might have been a Jewess, sitting up in the bow with a little boy about 3 years old in her arms, little boy screaming with fright and hiding his head between her breasts as if he was trying to burrow right into her, and the woman putting her arms around him and comforting him, although she was blue with fright herself. All the time covering him up as much as possible, as if she thought her arms could keep the bullets off him. Then the helicopter planted a 20-kilo bomb in among them, terrific flash, and the boat went all to matchwood. Then there was a wonderful shot of a child's arm going up, 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 right up into the air. A helicopter with a camera in its nose must have followed it up, and there was a lot of applause from the party seats. But a woman down in the prole part of the house suddenly started kicking up a fuss and shouting they didn't oughter have showed it, not in front of the kids. They didn't. It ain't right. Not in front of kids. It ain't. Until the police turned her out. I don't suppose anything happened to her. Nobody cares what the proles say. Typical prole reaction.
And of course, the hope lies with the proles, which I take to mean creative, non-violent, grassroots vegan activism. In the real world of 2011, nobody would really get so excited to laugh at others being killed or left to die, or to want to watch them being executed in public, right?
Hard, you know, you have to kind of say, well, there was 9/11, that was 10 years ago, remember?
But it never really could work, could it? I mean, they are backward. The first chapter of your book is all about how you're in a football stadium or a soccer stadium and they're cutting a guy's head off.
Right.
And you talk to the people and they say, well, you guys have TV, we have this.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a bad sign, right?
That's a bad sign.
Well, yeah, but that's in a country like Australia, Istan, or something. It could never happen in a developed country elsewhere, right?
Yes, sir. Ah, get some, baby! Get some! Get some! Get some! Get some! Get some! Come on! Get in! Come on! Get some! Get some! Yeah! Yeah! Anyone who runs is a VC. Anyone who stands still is a well-disciplined VC. You guys ought to do a story about me sometime.
Why should we do a story about you?
Because I'm so good. That ain't no shit neither. I've done got me 157 dead killed. And 50 water buffaloes too. Them are all certified.
Any women or children?
Sometimes.
How can you shoot women and children?
Easy. You just don't need them so much. Ain't war hell?
Hey, Jordan. Now, come on now. That's a clip from the 1987 classic.
Full Metal Jacket.
It's not real. It's not like there could be actual footage from that country's attack helicopters, effortlessly blowing away innocent civilians and possibly leaked by some guy called Julian Assange and his WikiLeaks thing. You know, innocent people just going about their daily business in their own country, right? Right? Right. This is my rifle, this is my gun, this is for fighting, this is for fun. No, there's simply no way real people, and from the real America, could get excited about watching other people be killed. Right, Wing?
You're unrealistic! I mean, you're pro-life, yet.
Your state has executed 234 death row inmates, more than any other governor in modern times. Have you...
What was that? You're afraid of death panels, yet for uninsured coma patients...
Are you saying the society should just let him die?
No. Yeah!
That's the crowd. Yeah!
Yeah, let our neighbors die. We'll get their stuff. Yeah, serves them right for making our God angry. We could never be living in the world of 1984, living in a blind panic caused by the government, with everyone feeling as though they have to contribute to the war effort, support our troops and not complain as their standard of living, their rights both decline into near Australia status. From the 25th of September edition of 60 Minutes.
The strategy is to put force on display. At random, 100 police cars will swarm part of town just to make a scene. It happens with complete unpredictability. Cops signal subway trains to stop to be searched, and sometimes they hold the trains until they've eyeballed every passenger.
Can you imagine that? Well, if you live in New York City, you don't have to imagine. Oh yeah, sorry, I missed the plane because of all the shoe-taking-off rituals, the naked body scanners, the body cavity probe. And then, when I managed to find an example of this nation's public transport, the corrupt police stopped all the trains and went round glaring at every passenger, and that took another hour. Good times ahead. A chicken friend for everyone to pat. I think it's easy to link veganism to non-violence, the harming of human animals, the harming of non-human animals, the teachings of some wacky, blue-haired mascot, a 2-meter-tall, 8-year-old. Did I mention he has blue hair? And has the common New Zealand name of Iron Brian? To link that character in our schools, telling our kids we have to buy the magical plastic-wrapped packets produced by his corporate overlords to that of a guerrilla grassroots campaign, asking us to sign away all our loyalties to an image of Hen Mother, who advocates respect for animals. We can't fix a violent situation with more violence. Gee, a young man's been shouted at all his life, made fun of in front of his peers, after being drafted into the nation's latest pointless war in a faraway land, a culture he doesn't understand. You find him hypnotically locking and loading his rifle, while sitting on a toilet late at night, while he mutters away in the dark about how beautiful and perfect the gun is. Seems like a real good time to scream and yell at him, right? Now that makes sense. Why don't you insult him a little more while you move towards him?
In the name of Jesus Christ, are you animals doing in my head?
Hey, I have to give him this though. I'm glad the drill sergeant can understand that we too are animals, at least in his head he can put it together that we're non-human animals, we're human animals. Huh, good one.
Why is Private Pyle out of his bunk after lights out? Why is Private Pyle holding that weapon? Why aren't you stomping Private Pyle's guts out?
Sir, it is the private's duty to inform the senior drill instructor that Private Pyle has a full magazine and is locked and loaded, sir!
Now you listen to me, Private Pyle, and you listen good. I want that weapon, and I want it now. You will place that rifle on the deck at your feet and step back away from it.
What is your major malfunction, numbnuts? Didn't Mommy and Daddy show you enough attention when you were a child?
Or, you could try and talk him down from the situation by talking about chicken friends and luck dragons and funny little stories about totalitarian worlds where everyone is being watched by surveillance cameras and armed police. You know, fiction?
That's all we have time for. Catch us next time on New World Order. Remember, love your country, don't question politicians, especially when they have a winning smile and great hair. And you'll be part of the New World Order.
Well, if there has to be a New World Order, Why not one based on peace and respect for everyone? And where better to start than Invercargill, New Zealand, the bottom of the world, now home to a 12-member vegan society. Thank you for listening to Coexisting with Non-Human Animals. You can find the script for this episode, as well as downloads for every episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals at coexistingwithnonhumananimals.co.nz. If you want to contact me, I'd really love to hear from you. Please send me an email to info@invsoc.org.nz, invsoc.org.nz. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter, Jordan Wyatt, W-Y-A-T-T. Thank you for listening. And remember, obey Hen Mother.
Away from the notion of animals as things and toward the moral personhood of animals. The choice is ours. If you're not vegan, go vegan. It's easy. It's better for you. It's certainly better for the planet. And most importantly, it's the morally right thing to do.